A quick note for our listeners. This Radio Parkies presentation is sponsored by YOPN Network and includes people who have been living with Parkinson's for quite some time. The vocal challenges that you hear are due to the progression of this disease as well as deep brain stimulation surgeries. And we come as we are here. Everyone has a purpose and a contribution, and everyone is welcome. Thank you for listening.
You are unique, active, determined, resilient. You are not your diagnosis, and you are not alone. This is Young Onset Parkinson's Network. We believe young onset Parkinson's disease does not define you. You define it. We are a safe place to learn, connect, and engage within a supportive community that actually gets it, because we've got it too. Welcome to Young Onset Parkinson's Network. Living well starts here.
We'll be back with Merlin in approximately 45 seconds.
Lots of people used to know me, but only as the Batman. I'm Merlin Tuttle. I've studied bats for more than 60 years, and I'm still alive and happy about studying them. When I was in high school, a friend told me about a cave not far from my home. I got my father to go with me. We went and found a real neat colony of several thousand gray bats. What I found was that they were only there in the spring and the fall. That must mean they're migrating. The book said they didn't migrate. When at that age you make a discovery like that that's totally contrary to what everybody believed before, that can get you pretty excited. I've spent my career showing the relationship between bats and human well-being, and a very good place to start when it comes to showing the value of bats is working with farmers.
My name's Troy Swift. We're in the pecan business as well as the lumber business.
Troy is testing bat houses in his pecan orchards and provides an ideal opportunity for me and other scientists to demonstrate the values of bats to people. When I first decided to go into conservation, nearly everybody thought all bats were rabid. We now understand that they're consuming up to 10 tons of insect pests nightly. If there's one thing that can unify people, it's bats.
Welcome to the YOPN podcast, a podcast that amplifies the extraordinary stories of individuals living with Parkinson's disease. I'm your host, joined today by Mike Qualia and Corinne Snow. And today we have a remarkable guest, Dr. Merlin Tuttle, renowned for his groundbreaking work on bat conservation. Despite being recently diagnosed with Parkinson's, Dr. Tuttle continues to inspire us all with his unwavering commitment. Let's delve into his journey and explore his indomitable spirit. So welcome, Merlin. It's really nice to meet you. I've taken a little bit of time to look into you. I know Corinne and Mike have as well, and you're a very inspiring feller. Thank you.
Well, I try to be, and I am delighted to have this opportunity to perhaps encourage some others.
Start off by telling us a little bit about your background. I like to think of you as Batman. I think a lot of other people probably would too. We bring you here because you also have Parkinson's disease. So you've lived an extraordinary life, and now you're faced with extraordinary circumstances. And I just want to get a little bit of background on that extraordinary life, if you don't mind. Where are you from? What are you all about, my friend?
I was conceived in Texas, born in Hawaii, and lived all over. I got interested in bats when I was in high school, and have been passionately interested in research and conservation of bats ever since. In fact, I've been doing that for close to 65 years.
So bats, it's an interesting topic, and it's probably something that we'll talk about for most of this hour, believe it or not. And I'm hoping that we can tie it in to Parkinson's, and that'll be an interesting conversation. And before we get started, have you noticed any correlations right off the top that bats have to Parkinson's? Has your journey into bats in the world of caves and everything else you're doing, how does that correlate to Parkinson's for you?
My neurologist tells me that exposure to pesticides is very strongly correlated with neurological disorders such as Parkinson's. And I lived in California in a place when I was young where spray planes came right over our house. On my website at merlintuttle.org, I actually have a whole section on the issue of pesticides and how they're affecting the environment and us humans.
So now how does that tie into bats? I'm guessing that somehow bats could reduce our usage of pesticides, right?
That's right. Bats are very important to the balance of nature and keeping insects in control. They consume vast quantities of insects. In fact, right here in Texas, it's been estimated conservatively that our bats are worth $1.4 billion a summer in elimination of crop pests. I tell people that every time we lose another bat, we just become that much more addicted to chemical pesticides that are already affecting so many things that it's hard to even name them all. Alzheimer's, a whole raft of neurological problems.
So I think you're answering my next question, which is why is it important to conserve these animals? Are you telling me that they have the possibility of eliminating our usage of pesticides or our need to use as many pesticides, thereby having a decrease in the possibility of Parkinson's disease situations derived from those pesticides?
Again, in my website under pesticides and perspective, I talk about the fact that prior to the first use of pesticides in America, we had beautiful crops. And in fact, we lose more crop to pests today than we did before we had pesticides. Pesticides have been a very unhealthy, inappropriate solution to our pest problems. It's kind of like giving heroin-laced candy to a child. He doesn't need it until he gets addicted. One of the things that I'm very involved in is population ecology. And when you start using pesticides, you invariably more effectively kill the predator of the bad insect that you want to get rid of than you do the pest. And in the United States, since pesticides first came into use, we have almost doubled the amount of crop losses. And in that same period, we have greatly increased the amount of pesticides and the toxicity of pesticides that we use. The only species that can give us a lot of trouble harming our crops are the ones that reproduce very rapidly in large numbers. Those insects are controlled by smaller populations of predators. The pest is always able to evolve resistance to a pesticide faster than the predator can. And so I once investigated a proposed spraying program for the state of Wisconsin. And what I found was that in just a few sprays of a pesticide that was said to be of no threat to humans, we would kill off most of the mosquito-eating fish, 90-some percent of the caddisfly larvae that fit on mosquito wigglers. What would happen is the company that was proposing mosquito control in the state was saying, we'll give you free service for a year, and then you can evaluate and decide whether you like it or not. Well, after a year of free service, we're going to kill off a good share of our natural controls of mosquitoes. And so then the next year, if we opt that now we don't want this service anymore, we're going to get eaten alive by mosquitoes, and there'll be a huge demand that we need it. That's the first step, you know, towards serious addiction.
When did you first notice, because you've been working in this field for a very long time, when did you first notice this trend towards needing some external source other than nature to take care of mosquitoes? It wasn't after the whole H1N1 thing, was it?
No, it's been known for a long time. Entomologists call it the pesticide treadmill. We have to keep using more pesticides, more toxic pesticides to achieve the same result. In the state of New York, the health department actually monitored for something like 15 years, the effect, how much they gained by spraying pesticides to kill, I don't think it was West Nile, but it was one of those.
Yeah, one of those strains. I can't remember. They had said that mosquitoes were the cause of it. I remember that being in the news quite prevalent.
Well, after all those years, what they found was that they had 15-fold more mosquitoes than when they started.
So here in Newfoundland, we are overrun by mosquitoes. You can't go outside in the evenings, but I've never in my life seen a bat. I'm 46 years old and I've never seen a bat. And when I was asked to do this, I was like, I can't believe I got to tell this man I've never seen a bat. I don't know if our population of bats is low in Newfoundland. We've only got two different species on this island. Like, I was very interested in your bat houses, because I'd like to attract some bats.
That sounds like that's the answer to the pesticide problem, is more bat houses, right, Merlin?
It certainly helps. There is no one way that we eliminate those kinds of problems. This gets down to biodiversity. And we hear a lot about the importance of biodiversity, but very few of us really understand what it's about. In one instance in the Mediterranean, scientists put up bat houses strategically located around rice fields, and they showed that over a period of years, they were able to attract enough bats to end the need for pesticide spraying for the moths that were harming their rice crops. However, they pointed out that had there not been a park next to the rice fields, that this would have never worked, because after you harvest the rice and there are no more pest moths that attack it, where are the bats going to eat? The bats, if they don't have diversity of plant life in the area, they have no place to go to find insects when the rice isn't there. So the more diversity we have, the more kinds of plants, the more kinds of insects we'll have that feed on them. And, you know, too many of us have an attitude that insects are all bad. God, if something would just kill all insects, we'd be fine. If something killed all insects, we'd probably have maybe a few weeks at most more to live.
It's that proverbial locust swarm that we all fear. It's going to kill off all the crops and starve us. We got to kill off all everything. And then the spiders. Everybody's always afraid of spiders, too. But they take care of insects. I suspect bats, they take care of, you know, more insects than just the mosquitoes. And having them around, I'm sitting here interested in what on earth brings a man like you to want to study bats. Most men, I've seen bats up close and kind of gotten interested in them. I've never been inclined to really grab a hold of one and hang on to it and pet it and make it my pet and train it or anything like that. But You do, and you've learned so much that now we can learn from as well. And it's funny to then pin that back on Parkinson's disease. And I want to ask you two questions. The first one is, how'd you get interested in bats? And the second one is, now that you're living with Parkinson's, all the adventures that you used to go on, you know, chasing after these bats, what do you do to keep going on those adventures?
I just don't give in to sometimes not feeling up to it. I've been very lucky. My neurologist says that I'm not only lucky, but part of my luck is driven by determination. Just to go back for a moment about the value of the bats, one free-tail bat, like living our bridge in the middle of Austin here, can catch enough migrating moths in a single night to prevent them from laying eggs on crops that would otherwise force farmers to spend $75 an acre. One bat can protect a farmer from having to spray multiple acres just from one night. And bats that eat mosquitoes can catch up to 1,000 mosquito-sized insects in an hour. And they do have impact. We can talk about that later, but I'll get back to your question, how do I persevere? I first found that I had Parkinson's because I went on a trip where it was really kind of crazy, but there are two of us who are really, really passionate about what we did. We both had reputations for working around the clock. And on that trip, I think I averaged, this is a trip to photograph bats and study bats in Thailand. I think I averaged about 3 hours a night sleep on that trip. And by the end of the trip, I was walking around leaning left so bad that one of my Thai guides would follow me around. And when I'd be taking a picture, he'd get on my left side to be sure I didn't fall over. By the time I got back from that trip, it was very clear to everybody that knew me that I had something wrong. Early on, probably when I was turning close to 60, medical doctor friends started telling me that I had familial syndrome because they'd see my fingers trembling. But no one in my family had ever had familial syndrome, and no one was quite sure what the problem was. But when I came back from my trip to Thailand, leaning so far left that it was a wonder I hadn't fallen over and hurt myself, they decided to do a brain scan, I guess an MRI. It was at that point they discovered that I had a meningioma tumor that was the size of a golf ball. And my surgeon who removed it told me to get my life in order and say my prayers and hopefully the surgery would go well. They removed a tumor the size of a golf ball. Then the doctor went on vacation and I started having strange symptoms that I didn't think I should be having. So I was calling the office and they were saying, oh, well, don't worry. It's probably just one of the odd normal things that happens after brain surgery. And when the doctor got back, I went to see him as quickly as I could. And they took me directly from his office to emergency surgery. And what had happened was during the first operation to get rid of the tumor, they had inadvertently infected me with a bacteria in my brain. It had gotten into my skull, so they had to remove quite a chunk of skull. And then they had to kind of leave that for several months while they built a plate to take the place of the bone they had taken out. And so for I think it was a couple of months, I looked like a mule had kicked me. You know, there was just this big indentation in my head.
Did you continue your adventures? I just want to call them adventures because when I think of you kind of like a movie character.
Well, a lot of people thought I was crazy, but yes, I didn't give up any of my planned trips. I went to Baja and photographed bats pollinating cacti. During that trip, I actually found that if I was going to sneeze or something and I'd put pressure on my body because I was about to sneeze or cough, that this depressed area would inflate.
Oh my gosh.
So I just made a joke out of it. You know, somebody would ask me what my problem was. I said, oh, I got a great party trick here. Watch this. And I'd make it inflate. And there was actually a a video taken of that on that trip that was shown at an international research conference later. Then after I came back, they had to perform yet a third surgery to put the plate in. And once that was in, it was only after that that we finally discovered that I had Parkinson's in addition to these other problems. My neurologist tells me that Parkinson's even now isn't my only problem. When I was younger, I had things like encephalitis and malaria, and she thinks that I had nerve damage from the high fever from malaria and some of those kind of things. So I have Parkinson's on the one side, recovery from the surgery on another, and on a third area, apparently hand tremors from neurological damage from high fever.
Yet you're still interested and you're still out there exploring through the pain, through the struggle. How do you do that?
As my neurologist has pointed out, because I have so much motivation in what I do, I love what I do. I very much enjoy studying bats. I very much enjoy conserving them. I'm very involved, not just in conserving bats, but in doing it in a way that helps people. And I have what I call a policy of winning friends rather than battles when people disagree and they hate. You know, a lot of people don't necessarily agree with me as to their attitudes about bats. You know, having a win more friends than battles attitude is very helpful. I feel so good and motivated by the accolades I get for doing good things that I believe in. I just got an email this morning from a person who said that, you know, I changed her whole life, and she was so impressed with my approach to when I disagree with somebody, to winning them to be a friend first and influencing them later, instead of going to battle with them over something we disagreed on. And at this point, having been working at conserving bats in a manner that helps people for so long, I get so many accolades. It's very inspiring and motivating to keep hearing people say, you really changed my life, you influenced me. And I hope that having Parkinson's is going to add to what I can do to help people, motivate people.
So I guess for me, I use goats and farm animals and sheep as my form of therapy for my Parkinson's. I assume that that's what bats do for you. It's a form of therapy for your Parkinson's.
I don't know whether they form a therapy or not. What I do know is that if there weren't any bats, life would change quite a bit. There's so little known about that, about bats, and that's why so many people fear them. We fear the unknown. But I am having great fun making new discoveries about bats and sharing them with people. I have probably reached more than 15 million people in more than 70 countries with my messages about bats just in the last few months. And it's fun. I enjoy it. I enjoy the accolades. There's nothing that keeps you cheered up more than public approval and people complimenting you for what you're doing. That's a big motivator.
So Merlin, with the goats, Corinne is talking about goat therapy where they sit around and pet goats, right? Corinne, you pet them. Could we do something like that with bats, do you think? Could you sit around and pet bats?
No, I certainly don't recommend that. Bats are gentle animals. They only bite in self-defense. I have tamed them. I have known very affectionate bats. I've known bats that recognized individual humans and formed bonds with them. But I do not recommend trying to keep a pet bat. It's way too complicated. And the bat that most people would be able to catch to try to make a pet of would probably be a sick bat, because any bat that's healthy is smart enough to know to try to stay away from people, that people are dangerous.
So I've read about a lot of your adventures, and it's very amazing what you've done. What would you think would be your most standout adventure that you've done, or dangerous? And what's your plans from here on? Like, where's your next planned visit?
I don't know how to describe what would be the most dangerous, because I don't like to get off talking more about me than the conservation I'm interested in. But just to put it briefly, I have been captured by terrorists, captured by communist insurgents. I've been hunted by Aborigine Indians who didn't like where I was working.
But then you went back, is the funny thing in that story, is you were hunted by him, and then you went back and say nuts anyways. So yeah. You're a stubborn man too, eh, Merlin?
But you know, all these being charged by elephants, stalked by tigers, and everything, it adds up to a bunch of good stories. And generally speaking, now in my life, when something really bad happens, I just take the attitude, well, this will make a hell of a good story. And I must say, I get the impression that a lot of people are a bit embarrassed about having Parkinson's, as though it's something that they deserved or earned, or, you know, the bad behavior. We can't help the fact that we have Parkinson's, but I personally take great pride in being able to still accomplish a lot that I'm very pleased with, despite having Parkinson's.
As we should. Most people look up to us. Once we develop this disease and start doing well with it, most people who don't have struggles are looking at us like, wow, I need to put more effort in. Do you get that response from folks?
Well, I fast walk for 2 miles most mornings. I go to a workout session with a personal instructor twice a week. I often don't want to do those things, I can tell you for sure. My wife every now and then has to practically threaten to beat me up if I don't go for my workout. You know, I'll say, well, I'd like to, but I'm too busy right now. Being careful about my health, eating a good diet, exercising well, and having motivation to keep my mind really active are probably why I'm still functioning pretty well.
When you say fast walking, what do you mean by that?
Not quite trotting, but a very fast walk. I was running until just a couple years ago. For the first like 5 years of having Parkinson's, I was still running a couple miles a morning.
Now, are you following like a John Pepper program?
Well, the first time I fell, I thought it was just a bad, you know, just unfortunate. But then I was told that I was dragging my left toe and that was going to make me more vulnerable to running, to falling while running. And for the first 2 or 3 years, even after I knew that, I kept running. And I just thought I'd be careful. And it worked for the most part. But what I found was that about once every year, I'd take a big tumble. And that was when I would get lax and quit thinking so much about keeping my toes up while I was running, because I hadn't had a problem in so long. And now I've realized that in my 80s, I just can't afford to break a hip or something. Fast walking is going to do me probably as much good as running. And why put myself to that extra risk of shortening my life ability to function? Right now, I am not counting on it, but I'm certainly hopeful that I can still be actively working when I'm 90.
I think that you're well on your way there. And my inner corrective exercise specialist has a question for you. Do you think the adventures you've been on in the rugged terrain, the altered terrain that you're constantly walking on and that you're used to since well back into what, the 60s, going on all these adventures, do you think that has set you up really well to deal with a disease that affects your gait and makes it difficult in navigating that type of terrain?
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure that has helped a lot.
And continuing that is, it's like if you don't ride a bike, yeah, you know how to do it, but it's not quite as well, right? And that's where the fall risk comes in. So that's one cool thing about you is you're in your 80s, but you're still going on this altered terrain and going on these adventures.
Well, here's what I find. One of the biggest threats to my future is when I sit behind a desk writing too much and don't get out and go in difficult terrain. Just last week, someone told me about a bat cave to check, and they didn't, you know, I thought it was something that you could step out of your car and maybe walk in the entrance, and it turned out to be 100 feet down the mountain, and the mountain was near vertical, slippery, royal pain. I just had street clothes on, but I got out a extendable walking cane and used it because the worst danger is falling forward, at least in my case. So I used it not to fall forward, and I made it down the whole 100 feet down to the cave, and it was a little rugged inside, so I didn't try to do that too. But what I find now is that if I go fly fishing, which I love to do when I have a chance, which I often don't have time, but if there's, you know, slippery rocks and stuff, or if I have to go to a hike to a cave and there's uneven terrain, I find that my balance and coordination and just about everything about me is better off when I get home than when I left. So these things aren't a threat. They're actually a help. And on those trips, oftentimes people, you know, here's this old guy that's in his 80s and he's got Parkinson's. Let's not let him carry anything. We got to do everything for him. I tell them that every time they insist on carrying something for me, they're shortening my life, that I need these things to keep me going.
The hard life is the right life to live, it seems, eh?
That's right. I mean, faced with no challenges, you're not going to make it for as long, or that's my belief.
And for folks to understand, Merlin's a very humble guy. The challenges that he's faced in life, as somebody who was searching to further our science and understanding of the world around us, so thank you for doing this. This guy was an expeditionist in the Amazon. He faced off with bandits. He explored into areas where the indigenous culture had never experienced other human beings other than their own tribe and those surrounding them. So this is a person who has explored the frontier of humanity, now dealing with Parkinson's, that Mike has brought you. And Mike, how did you find this guy? That's the question. Like, where on earth did you come up with Merlin? This is like, this to me, this is like if I was to be given an opportunity back in the day to have an interview with Lewis and Clark, or to, you know, talk to some of the people who explored Africa for the first time out of Europe. I look at Merlin and I'm amazed that I'm sitting here talking with him. And the funny thing is, and that's the beautiful thing, is Parkinson's is the only reason I'm here with you, Merlin. And I think a lot of people look at this as this huge curse, but the only reason I'm here is because I opened up to do an interview with Mike one day, and now you're here doing an interview with us. And I think that if people can shift their mindset to, this isn't a curse, this is something I'm dealing with, but there's a way through it. And if I just continue through, live life like Merlin, keep exploring life's frontiers, things are okay. Wouldn't you say, Merlin?
Well, there's always somebody in greater pain or in greater need than us. And to the extent that we do our best to help those people in whatever way our training and physical ability permits, to that extent, we're going to feel better and be happier. And it's actually, I think, a major part of keeping us healthy when we go out and do things that we really believe in for other people.
So Merlin, I think you're an inspiration because I take the same mindset as you. I get up when I have bad days, I force myself to get up and move and keep moving, and because I do feel better. And I take the mindset that not that I choose to do it, I get to do it. And I'm glad that I get to do it so long as I can. But it's very hard to inspire others to have that mindset. So how can you see inspiring others to take a better mindset when it comes to Parkinson's?
The mindset, I actually take pride in both the combination of my age and that I have Parkinson's. As a point, it's kind of like the unspoken message I'm giving is, if I can be this old and have this big of challenges ahead of me and have Parkinson's and I'm still doing this well, there must be hope for others who have these problems. The main thing I see is just the determination that I don't think I would have the determination to keep going if there weren't so many people that were giving me positive feedback with regard to what I'm doing. It's been said that the two most addictive things in the world are opiate drugs and the admiration and good and thank yous from fellow humans for things you've done that have benefited others. I think just about none of us that can't find somebody who needs help more than we do, who could make a good friend and be appreciative. And to the extent we succeed in making friends, not feeling pathetic like we need somebody to help us, but finding ways to help those who need it more than we do, to me, that's a very strong motivation.
I want to take the time that we have left to bring you back to your main focus that you want to use, it seems like, the rest of your time on this earth, thankfully, to promote, which is the conservation of bats. And I've had this nagging suspicion, and I don't know how long, since I was a teenager at least, just in science class, I have a feeling that bats and whales are related. It's always struck me that they're both mammals. They both have echolocation. They both have, you know, a common land dwelling ancestor. And I wanted to get your opinion on that. Do you think that whales and bats are actually closely related? And do you think it's possible that they could have a common land dwelling ancestor?
Well, they probably did, but that's getting further back than my expertise extends.
I love that you agree, though. Thank you.
What I can tell you is that a fellow who unfortunately passed away in the last couple of years, Jack Pettigrew, was a famous neurologist from Australia. He discovered about 20 years ago that all of the megabats, that's a large proportion of the world's bat species, have crossing over neurons between the eyes and the midbrain, just like we do. And up until his discovery, it was absolutely believed fervently that you were a primate if your neurons crossed over between your eyes and your midbrain, and you weren't a primate if they didn't. When they found that a large proportion of the world's bats had the primate crossover, all of a sudden they didn't want to believe this anymore. But even Linnaeus, when he first was naming things, he put bats in the same order with primates.
So this goes deeper than whales, which was my first question. You're telling me that we're related to bats?
Well, we don't know for sure. There are many assumptions being made in these models that if one of those assumptions is wrong, the whole thing goes down the tube. So you got to be careful what you believe. But I can point out that we do have many similarities with bats. Linnaeus thought that bats were primates because they have pectoral breasts, paired pectoral breasts instead of a series of breasts down the body, like say a pig or something like that.
They also have limbs and phalanges, correct?
Right. Their wings are just extended fingers. Bats, before the advent of modern medicine, they had lifespans very similar to humans. They're the longest lived mammals on the planet for their size. Even small bats have been known to live more than 40 years in the wild.
They're older than humans too, aren't they?
Much. And there were modern bats in the fossil record that go back at least 60 million years. And of course, they have to be a lot older.
That's just after dinosaurs are 65 million years ago. That's just after dinosaurs, right?
Right. Well, they actually overlapped a bit with dinosaurs.
Crazy. So bats were around at the same time as dinosaurs.
Yeah.
And we're related to bats. So kind of in a sort of way, we were around with dinosaurs, right?
And there's a lot that we could learn from bats. They almost never get arthritis or cancer.
They get a lot of rest. They have a high nitrogen diet and they're active a lot. That's interesting. We could learn a lot from bats.
Well, unfortunately, what we mostly hear is from people who profit by our fear of bats. Fear is a prime selling point when you're trying to sell something. You know, just scare something about how bad it's going to be if he doesn't protect himself. And on that note, here I've studied bats in 45 countries for more than 60 years, sometimes surrounded by literally millions at a time in a single cave. I have handled hundreds of species and I'm still healthy. I've never been attacked. I've never contracted disease. And yet we keep hearing about how dangerous bats might be in supposedly spreading disease. What we should be figuring out is just how dangerous the world might become if we lost our bats and their services that we depend on.
It's like the bees, you know, where we tend to, as humans, make choices that kill off our resources. I'm curious, so what makes you think is the root cause of our fear of bats? And I want to posit a possibility before you answer. I don't know how far back in human history the fear of bats goes, but I think the name a certain feared emperor took of Dracula, being that is actually the name of the largest bat known in history, has a little bit to do with that. What do you think?
Well, legends involving vampires long preceded discovering a bat that drank blood. And there's no evidence that vampires have ever existed anywhere but in the New World, and now only in Latin America. But even
that's interesting how that name, it being that the Dracula, I don't know the exact name, is Desmodus Draculi, something like that. They exist in Latin America, but we're talking about a Romanian emperor that took the same name and then had the reputation of turning into a bat. How does that happen?
The old bat legends, actually, many of them actually began around horrible things that people actually did to other people, not things that bats did to anybody. In fact, it's interesting. All of the first bats scientifically described as vampire bats eat fruit instead. They had big teeth for getting into hard rinds on certain kinds of fruit.
And even those ones that eat insects, they were eating insects off of animals until the insects were gone and then feeding on the animals, right?
Well, we don't know. That's speculation. Even vampires are really neat animals. They share information. They help each other in need. They'll even risk their own life to give away part of a meal to help another vampire not starve. They adopt orphans. They're very intelligent. In fact, one thing we haven't talked about is the intelligence of bats. I've experienced that time and again, that they'll learn a particular human's voice, or I can train them to come on call to my hand. I can train them to do all kinds of things.
It's interesting. We, drawing back to the whales, we see that same relationship with intelligence in them. I'm curious, do you think that bats have anything to offer Parkinson's as far as echolocation goes? Do you think that possible, because we just had conversations with some technologically advanced folks, I guess would be the best way to put it. I want to think that somehow the way that bats use echolocation to navigate their territory could be useful in a technological sense, if we could somehow mimic that. Have you ever pondered that, Merlin?
Well, much of what's known about navigation for the blind has come from studies of bats. Echolocation isn't one of my stronger areas of research, but we could talk for an hour about the incredible sophistications going on in that area.
I wish we had another hour, Mike. You're going to have to reschedule, Merlin.
Bats can... their echolocation has been guesstimated by the foremost authority who ever lived when it came to bats, estimated that bat echolocation was billions of times more efficient than anything man had ever developed on a watt per watt, ounce per ounce basis.
And it's misconception that they're blind too, right? They can see as well as us on top of that echolocation.
Most bats see quite well. They can navigate with sound, but they also have, most of them, good vision.
Do the perception of the public around bats impact what the work you're doing and any donations that you get? Because the perception of bats is very negative.
Well, the perceptions are definitely negative for most people, but think about this. None of us want to be seen on our deathbed. Most bats are only seen when they're injured and die, and that's the reason we see them. An intelligent bat is staying as far away from people as he can. People are dangerous. They kill bats. They don't kill us.
If you guys want to see, the listeners, if you want to see a demonstration of a gentle bat, I would go to YouTube and look up Merlin and his visit on David Letterman, because those bats and the way that you handle them, you can tell. I felt like you were hanging on to my dachshund, my little wiener dog. You know, it seemed no different, right?
Well, bats are very gentle animals. The odds of being attacked by one are just about zero. What I point out to people that fear bats, you know, it's interesting. You hear that. You're all the time hearing how dangerous bats are because they got rabies. They're not any more likely to transmit a disease to you than other animals are. They can transmit rabies, but so can our dogs and cats and a whole lot of other animals. But let's put that in perspective. Only 1 to 2 people annually in all of the U.S. and Canada combined contract rabies from a bat. And those are people who picked up a sick one, got bitten, and didn't do anything about it. For anybody that just leaves bats alone, they're incredibly valuable to have in our yards. Life is going to be better with more bats.
And more so than just leave them alone, we want to encourage people to look into bat houses. And I know that there's specific ways that they're supposed to be built. So I'm sure that there's places that people can go to look that up, and YouTube channels if you want to build your own. But my neighbor has one, and I never have mosquitoes in my yard because we constantly have bats. Every time dusk hits, the bats come out, and you can tell that they're just devouring all the mosquitoes, and they never hit us. We'll sit around the fire and never experience them. So I want to encourage our listeners, as we're wrapping up the hour, to go in and help out your conservation efforts. Can we talk a little bit about that and how we can help out with conserving these bats to cut down on the pesticides, cut down on the mosquitoes, and, you know, help Merlin?
Here's where you can get the latest information on bat houses.
And he's holding up a book, the Bat House Guide.
And if you're interested in adventure stories combined with bats, take a look at the Secret Lives of Bats book. I think you'll find either one or both very interesting.
So are those available on Amazon, Merlin?
Yes.
So Merlin Tuttle on Amazon, folks. If you just do a search, Merlin Tuttle on Amazon, you'll find both of those books and be able to read them. And is there a donation page or anything online that we can send folks to try and help fund these adventures you go on?
Go to MerlinTuttle.org, Merlin Tuttle's Bat Conservation. And we are extremely appreciative for help in saving bats.
It's med time, isn't it, Merlin? All right. And hey, that was a perfect time.
That was my Parkinson's warning.
That's a perfect time for us to wrap up this conversation, Mike. Great.
Let me say, bats are now the most endangered animals in America. They're incredibly endangered worldwide. Their loss is a direct threat to our future. And I would deeply appreciate it if you would consider contributing, joining my organization, Merlin Tuttle's Bat Conservation. We do everything possible to help bats help people. And if you think they might be interesting, take a look on our website. You can see thousands of kinds of bats, everything from tiny bats that weigh less than a penny to giants with nearly 6 foot wingspans. You can see cute ones. You can see dinosaur looking bats. Check it out. I think you'll find a lot of interesting information.
And that was MerlinTuttle.org. Again, MerlinTuttle.org. Mike.
You definitely changed my perception.
Me too. It's been an honor speaking with you, Merlin.
I just want to ask Merlin if you have so much knowledge in your head and the books and everything else. Is there anybody that's going to take your place when you can't do this anymore?
I'm doing the best I can. In fact, one of my big goals right now is to establish a bat education center here in Austin. You know, our city is now world famous for its colony of 1.5 million bats that would have been eradicated when they first tried to move into our downtown bridge had it not been for our efforts and in educating people to their benefits.
How do you think that has translated into the local crops? Do you think that has helped your local farmers? Have they acknowledged it in any way?
Well, our Parks and Wildlife Department estimates conservatively that they're saving Texans $1.4 billion a year in avoided pesticide use. They're truly incredible. We're making new discoveries all the time. I think it's very well worth your time to help bats because they help us. And through the Bat Education Center that we're planning to establish, we're going to be educating people not only in Austin, but millions come from all over the world to see our bats now. And that center is going to spread the message of how bats help people on a worldwide scale.
What's your next goal, or where's your next place you're going to visit?
Well, my next goal is actually to establish an endowment so that we can. I have 60 some years of unique observations on bats that are not likely to ever be made by another human. I've had incredible luck in having opportunities that few people ever get, and we've learned a lot. And one of the main things we've learned is that we need bats perhaps more than they need us. And so I'm passionate about leaving a bat education center, and that's my next big focus, but that doesn't stop traveling on bats' behalf. Three of my last speaking engagements about bats, one was in Zambia, one was in South Africa, and one was in Costa Rica.
I think, Merlin, throughout history, scientists have made discoveries and then implemented them on a small scale within their local community, which is exactly what you've done, on a large scale within the bat community, of course, but on a small scale globally. And I think that humanity tends to miss the opportunity of learning from that small adventure that scientist has gone on. I hope that we don't miss out on what you've done down there in Texas, because it's completely replicable. It's not anything that is needed more than just a little bit of effort, right? And the benefits are so plentiful.
That's right. And I'm not just planning to leave an education center. I'm training staff and have some very good people working with us. Very, very good people, all the way from the United Kingdom to the U.S. and Africa. And we are training as quickly as we can so that it won't be just me who knows these things. One of the things we're doing is producing videos and publications that will last long after I'm gone, so my knowledge won't disappear.
So when a man gets into his 80s and those around him are in a rush to absorb his knowledge, that man has lived a life that is deserving of this hour that we spent with you. I want to thank you so much for putting the effort that you put into that life, because it's been a hard life. You have not had it easy. You've intentionally made it hard so that you could learn these things and pass them on to us. Merlin, it's been an honor talking to you, and I mean that wholeheartedly. Somebody who has lived the life that you have has so much knowledge to glean that spending an hour with you is like just getting a crumb of your favorite cake, you know? So thank you so much for sharing your crumbs with us.
Well, thank you so much for giving me this opportunity. I hope I've encouraged a few of your listeners, and I'd be happy to assist in any way that I can at any time. I'm not just interested in bats. I'm interested in people as well.
You are a very fascinating and inspiring man.
Thank you.
So MerlinTuttle.org. Again, MerlinTuttle.org. Folks, go and learn a little bit more about bats and tamp down on the fear. These things are gentle creatures. They're only out there to help get rid of pests.
That'll do it for this episode, folks. Come back next time for more inspiring guests. Thanks for listening. Have a great night, everybody. Over the